with your weekend breakfast.
With Refilwe Mbakanyane on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Let's absolutely walk the talk on Weekend Breakfast and get to know the man behind the poetry, the man behind the novels, the man behind the cultural activism. Who am I talking about? My profile guest this morning is Mandla Langa. He's a poet, a short story writer, novelist and cultural activist. He grew up in Gwamashu in KwaZulu-Natal. His novel, The Lost Colors of the Chameleon, won the 2009 Commonwealth Writers' Prize for the Africa region. Mandla enrolled for a degree in English and philosophy at the University of Fort Hare, but was expelled in 1973 as a result of his involvement in the activities of the South African Student Organization, and that saw him going into exile in 1976. And of course, fast forwarding to a life back home in South Africa, where years later he was brought in to complete the second volume of Nelson Mandela's autobiography, which was left in an unfinished draft when Mandela died in 2009. That was published in 2017, called Dare Not Linger. Of course, we'll talk about Mandela's various novels and titles and works of literary work over the years. Those, of course, do include titles such as A Rainbow on a Paper Sky. They include titles The Tenderness of Blood, or Tenderness of Blood. But of course, we'll also discuss his latest novel, which is called The Lost Language of the Soul. It's my pleasure to welcome to Weekend Breakfast, Mandla Langa. Good morning, and thank you so much for agreeing to spend time with us today.
Good morning, Refilwe, and thank you for co-hearing this conversation. And good morning to your listeners, too.
An absolute treat to have you on the program, and it's been a while since you were on 702, so we feel particularly lucky. Thank you for making the time.
Thanks a lot, yeah.
So, Mandla, this conversation today, I guess we'll kickstart with the latest, and I guess most burning reason for why you have been doing the media circuit of late, and that is September. Your latest book, "The Lost Language of the Soul," that novel was published. And I'm going to just take the time now to read the blurb so that we're all on the same page, and those that are yet to read the book just get a sense of what we'll be kickstarting our conversation with. So if you'll humor me and bear with me for a few seconds whilst I read the blurb.
All right.
So the blurb goes like this. Joseph Mabaso is used to his father Sobhuza's long absences from the family home in Lusaka. Sobhuza is a freedom fighter and doing important work, and Joseph has learnt not to ask questions. But when Chanda, his mother, disappears without a trace, leaving him and his siblings alone, Joseph knows that something is terribly wrong. And so begins a journey physically arduous and dangerous and emotionally fraught that no 14-year-old boy should have to undertake alone. Following the most tenuous of threads, Joseph finds some unlikely guides along the way. Courageous Layla and her horses, Sis Violet and the guerrilla unit she commands, Mr. Chikwedere, stonecutter and Lissa trader, Madala at the Lesedi repatriation camp, who helps him find his voice, and Aunt Susie Juma, unofficial Zambian ambassador in Yeovil, Johannesburg, whose detective skills are legendary. As Joseph navigates unfamiliar and often hostile territory in a search for his parents, he's on a parallel journey of discovery, one of identity and belonging, as he attempts to find a safe house that's truly safe, a language that understands all languages, and a place in his soul that feels like home. Now, Mandla, this is such a beautifully written book, and in your conversations and your interviews in our last conversation about, this book and that particular knot that you were trying to tease out and establish and, I guess, get to the heart of, this title, The Lost Language of the Soul, what were you trying to work out or work on? Because this novel takes us via Joseph Mabaso, the protagonist, through a number of countries, starting off in Zambia and traveling through Botswana, traveling into South Africa. And there's a sense of community, but there's also a sense of displacement and constant searching. What was that thing that you were trying to tease out, and perhaps the abiding theme that you're trying to tease out and work out in your works, but especially this one?
Well, we have to start with the title itself, because part of the inspiration came from a book by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Soul of Black Folks. And I've always loved soul music, so that has had to feature in some way or the other. But to be more precise, I wanted to reflect the connectivity of and the universality, the commonality of our experience as South African, Southern African, African, continental people, you know, the commonality of our experiences, and the fact that we've all labored under some form of oppression one way or the other, be it colonialism, apartheid, you know, repression. And so, also speaking about the links in terms of what we have experienced, the blood that has been spilled in various parts of the continent, sometimes the blood being spilled being the blood of the people that hosted South Africans in various parts of the continent, and who, because those countries were harboring us, were helping us, were our sustenance. And so Joseph Mabaso then becomes the soul that connects that thread that takes us from Lusaga all the way into South Africa itself, and using various vehicles, sometimes opportunistically, but sometimes fortuitously, because there wasn't anything that he could have done. And so it tries to link the issues of gender in some small way, but much more importantly, the issues of violence, the issues of displacement, the fact that as South Africans, no matter how unpalatable this statement is, we owe a lot to the kindness of strangers. We owe a lot to the largesse of the people that actually had nothing, but were, you know, full of grace and gratitude for the human spirit to give us that kind of shelter, which made us what we are today.
Yeah. So, you know, in previous interviews, and of course talking about the genesis of this book, The Lost Language of the Soul, you talk exactly about that, that, you know, this book was, the story was inspired by some of the xenophobic violence that we saw in South Africa back in 2008. And you mentioned specifically Ernesto Alfabeto, who was beaten, who was stabbed with satellite in Ramaphosa informal settlement. And, you know, exactly that debt of gratitude, but I guess of better treatment, amongst other things, that we owe, you know, our African compatriots or fellow Africans whose countries took us in during the struggle. Just how you, as the features editors of the Sunday Times, Sue de Groot, said of your writing, just talk to us about how you take real life events, or perhaps those unpalatable events and truths rather, and you put them into fiction to tell stories that that are based on our realities, but to tell truths rather that we absolutely need to hear in South Africans. And what do you imagine that kind of debt of gratitude, or how that debt of gratitude ought to be repaid in what kind of material and meaningful ways in 2021? Because ultimately, in this book, in your latest book, The Lost Language of the Soul, we find out, or at least at the beginning, we think that Joseph Mabaso's job or his journey is to find his mother, is to find his father. But what we realize as we go along in this journey, that actually it is also a story about, if not repentance, then that debt of gratitude and paying it back or making things right. But, you know, it's a huge job to undertake, especially on behalf of other people. So in your thinking around how to have this conversation in the book, the stories that, or the decisions you made around what to include in the story and how to tell the story, what were they? How did they influence the storytelling?
I will start with the last part of your question, which is the issue or the question of the debt of gratitude, how we as South Africans can repay. One of the most important things is that as a country, even though we might be having our problems, South Africa still enjoys quite a huge reputation, you know, in world affairs. It enjoys a membership, you know, of the G20, for instance, and at the United Nations, its voice is one of the moral voices that still receives, you know, reception among member states. And I do believe that our role perhaps has got a lot to do with our diplomatic muscle, or should have a lot to do with our diplomatic muscle. I would believe also insofar as, you know, in SADC and in the African Union, we can play a much more inspirational and decisive role, so that those countries that were punished, you know, on our behalf can get back to some form of, get back to their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, I don't know now what's going on, for instance, with the program that was started in the mid 1996-97 of Nepad.
Yes.
Because Nepad was a glimmer of hope for the coherence of the southern, of the African experience in various forms, in culture, in industry, in trade, etc. And so these are some of the things that we've got to start rethinking as South Africans. How do we add value? But going back to the earlier part of your question, I just find it abhorrent that we did not have, because I think the warnings had been there much, much, much earlier that xenophobic violence was going to break out. And true to form, those warnings were never listened to, nor were they taken seriously. And we then unsurprisingly find outbreaks of violence, outbreaks of thuggery, widespread. You know, and the warnings have always been there. The signs have always been there. Anyone literate enough to read WhatsApp messages will know that something has always been brewing. And the question that we've got to ask ourselves is why no action was taken.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as an artist, as a writer, our role as a... Toni Morrison once said, she said, "I'm a teller of stories and therefore an optimist, a believer in the ethical bend of the human heart, a believer in the mind's disgust with fraud and its appetite for truth, a believer in the ferocity of beauty." As an artist then, one has got to be looking at all the things that are happening around them to shape them into some form, some beautiful structure, perhaps, an installation, a book, a poem that celebrates the lives of people and brings out the heroic, you know, tease out the heroic from all the detritus of failure. And so that's what I try to do with Joseph and the struggle of traveling all the way from Lusaka via so many untrustworthy vehicles.
Yes, absolutely.
All the way to look for his mom.
Yeah.
And now,
Go ahead.
I'm saying I did not know, because writers are essentially, artists are essentially schizophrenic. They start from an idea and they don't know where the hell that idea is going to lead them to. Same ditto with me. I started with a feeling, an understanding, a compulsion that something needs to be told. And so I did not know of a particular 14-year-old Zambian boy. And that is good, because you've got to create. People say you've got to write about what you know, but it's better to write what you don't know, because then you let your imagination run riot, as it did, I think, in the book.
So, and it does, and it's such a compelling, you know, the vehicle that you've chosen to tell the story, this 14-year-old Joseph Mabaso, who goes on such a treacherous journey and an unimaginable journey for someone this young, but a responsibility that he can't shrug off, right, or run away from. I guess this book reads like a palimpsest, right? So, yes, there's the story that you've written down as the novelist, as the artist. But of course, as a South African, I'm forever reading this text. Or I'm always reading this text and seeing other writing superimposed onto it, whether that's my own baggage, cultural and historic baggage that's being superimposed over what you are writing, or perhaps that's been, you know, that's just underneath the surface of your own writing because of what we've been written in, the history that's been written into us. And I really, you know, as you say, you've spoken about the genesis of the story, that the seed was planted years ago, but it just seems like such a timely book at the same time, right? A book for this moment, a book for reminders. So a past that in many ways is very, very wise, and talking about, even then, very aware, whilst it's set in the struggle, whilst it's set in the latter part of the struggle for liberation, in the early parts of those negotiations that would establish eventually the new South Africa, there's this awareness that nothing is perfect, that even amongst idealists and people that have laid down their lives for the liberation of their countrymen, they're also, I want to say the word sellout, not sellouts. But yeah, there are people who've been...
They are
frauds, they are spies, there are people who've been turned for a myriad reasons. And even those that aren't necessarily pure of heart, because of course, everyone here is a human being. So they're no sort of selfless and unblemished characters. And I found that really interesting. There's a voice that comes through in the story that reminds us as well that even as you proceed into the future, it's very important to be aware that you know, in the higher structures, perhaps of the MK or even of the ANC, as one of our characters reminds, or Joseph Mabaso, that there'll be those frauds, those spies that remain, or those people that have been strategically placed by the NAT government, because they're playing a long game. So don't be lulled into complacency. But I guess the greater warning in the text is that don't be lulled into complacency, thinking that, you know, this trajectory, this historic trajectory is a destination. It's in fact a journey.
You know, one of the things that I've seen happening in my life, in the history of so many struggles across the planet, across the globe, is that the people that are at the helm of movements, that are at the helm of whatever, bodies that are involved in struggle are themselves human, and they are impacted by, as you say, the vagaries, the exigencies, etc., of life. And we have said somewhere that, you know, if you look at the guerrillas, you look at people like Che Guevara, you look at Fidel Castro, etc., when you drill down, you'll find that they are intensely human, and they've got their, you know, triumphs, travails, tears, moments of extreme doubt about themselves. And so marry that with the fact that in South Africa, for the longest time, the South African, the National Party regime understood perfectly what it was going to be engaged in when it started the whole shebang of apartheid in 1948. The amount of preparation has been stated by no less a personage than Magnus Malan, who spoke about the battle, which was a battle for the soul of South Africa, is 80% diplomatic, cultural, whatever, and 20% military. That 80% has got a lot to do with what I think happened, that is making sure that they created the most enduring machinery for spying, infiltration, etc. So when, for instance, 1976 happened, this was, and when the ANC had to absorb quite a number of people coming from inside the country, that was the God-given moment for the regime to field in as many of its people as possible, I would believe. Mm-hmm. That's my belief. But much more importantly, this also meant that some of the people were placed in prisons on Robben Island. I mean, there's a story that I read when I was doing that research for Dare Not Linger, where there was a person or people inside Robben Island whom the ANC leadership there shunned because they had a feeling, they knew that this one was a plant. Mm. And so the book then borrows, takes some of that, of those tropes, and shapes them into a tellable story so that South Africans must know that sometimes the troubles that we are seeing 27 years after 1994, those troubles are troubles that emanate from some of those unresolved issues, all those trucks that were carrying thousands and thousands and thousands of volume of documents that were shredded and burned. All those secrets are the secrets that are now manifesting themselves into some of the issues that we are dealing with on an everyday basis in modern day South Africa. Mm. And so Joseph, then going back to my 14-year-old, Joseph is just one of those, you know, things that we use to try and tell a story that will embrace some of those happenings, some of that history that's unresolved. I've always liked saying that the future is certain, it is the past, it is still unpredictable. We are dealing with that unpredictable past that has come back to menace us.
Mm. When we come back from checking in with my colleague Michael Pedro and finding out what's happening in the world of sports, I'm going to continue my conversation with my profile guest this morning, who's author, a poet, and a cultural activist, Mandla Langa. We'll get to know more about the man behind the titles, talk family, talk exile, but of course talk creativity and creative inspiration in a time when it seems as though inspiration and sources or places of refuge and emotional and intellectual refuge are few and far between, but ultimately it can happen. It's going on 8:33 on Weekend Breakfast.
702.
Weekend Breakfast with Refilwe Mpakanyane.
Live, online,
smartphones,
DSTV channel 856,
92.7 and 106 FM.
It's 8:37 on the Sunday edition of Weekend Breakfast. If you've just tuned in, you're right on time for the second part of my conversation with novelist, cultural activist, and a poet, Mandla Langa. And we were talking, of course, of the genesis of our conversation is his latest novel. It's called The Lost Language of the Soul, published by Picador Africa. And glowing reviews, such a compelling read. And of course, one that I mentioned in our just before we went to that ad break and sports break, one that really centers our experience as South Africans, as Africans, not just in the, you know, in the struggle, but in the early years of democracy and, of course, in the situations that we find ourselves in contemporary South Africa. But we carry on the conversation now and, you know, tug at a theme or at a strand that was that is a large theme, an important theme in this book, The Lost Language of the Soul. And that is the theme of exile, the subject of exile and being far away from home, whilst, of course, being unable to influence or in your own way, being able to do what you can to influence, you know, the happenings at home, the goings on at home, but fundamentally being feeling powerless and being powerless in many, many instances. Mandla, if you would humor us and, you know, let us talk about your own experiences of life in exile, knowing that, you know, as I said in my introduction, you eventually had to leave your studies because of your involvement in student politics in your youth, and eventually making the decision to, or being forced to go into exile after spending 101 days in detention for your student activism. Those initial years or months, that initial period of leaving South Africa, not knowing when you would eventually return home, but also being unsure about how you would make a living, how you would occupy your time, and what life would be like beyond these borders, beyond what you'd known all along. Do you remember those times? Do you remember the memories perhaps that you held on to give you strength, to sort of feed the soul and say, this is what I'm fighting for back home? What is that period like for you?
Well, I left home on October 10, 1976, which was what was known as Kruger's Day, I think, in those years. And I went into Botswana, where I met my old compatriots from various parts of the struggle. One thing that was quite important was understanding the seriousness of what it was that we were going to be involved in. I was a member of Medu Art Ensemble, where I acted as a scribe, as an editor of our magazine or newsletter, Medu.
Mm-hmm.
It was around that time that I also went to Nigeria with Jonas Kwangwa, to FESTAC in 1977, February, which was a festival of arts, of African arts.
Yes.
And which embraced more than 70,000 participants from various parts of the world. What is important about that is that we might have an image of what Africa is all about as South Africans. You know, we tend to talk about Africa out there. But for me, it was very, very important to undergo that experience because I then began to be in touch with some of the strands that we might have been dreaming about, but which were quite remote. And there we were with all the writers, people like Nuruddin Farah, all sorts of writers, Ted Jones. I was with Dashiki, the musicians, Lefifi Tladi, etc.
Lovely.
And that was also, important because it was in Nigeria that the idea of Amandla, a cultural ensemble of the African National Congress, was worked out. That's where we met Oliver Tambo, Thabo Mbeki, who was the chief rep of the ANC in the region, in Nigeria. I touch on that because all those would have a lasting effect on the trajectory that became, that I then followed or took when it comes to cultural activism as part of political, of the political imperative. And then much, much later, I was in Lusaka. I was in, I went to do journalism for a year in Hungary, in Budapest, a place where everybody speaks the language that nobody speaks. You know, it's a, it was a very enlightening experience because it also exposed me to the politics of the Middle East, because there, as a student, we had all the nationalities from the Middle East, except, of course, for Israel and Iran, because at the time, Iran and Iraq were involved in battle. And then I went back to Lusaka, where I worked with Comrade Barbara Masigela in the setting up of the Department of Arts and Culture, and much, much later in the United Kingdom. But what was important about Lusaka, Zambia, was that it was a country where we then saw what it was for other people to pay for our being in their country. And so those were some of the earlier beginnings, glimmers of understanding what the world held in store for us. It was in Zambia that my brother was killed. I was in Zambia when my brother was killed in 1984. This was a man who was shot dead by, you know, by my comrades, some of whom I'd been in training with. Because he had been labeled an informer. And why I'm stating this is because it was an insuperably difficult thing to deal with because of, you know, the fact that I could not go home to bury him, and also the nature of his death was, for me, unpalatable.
Absolutely.
I think it is still unpalatable and will continue forming, being part of the matrix of my writing in terms of that theme that we touched on, of never looking at anything and at face value and believing that behind every act, every smile is a frown, believing that behind every expression of love and commitment, you have to be incredibly watchful. So it's that vigilance that has not made me paranoid, but that has given me a task of studying much more what humans are about and what the issue of living is about.
Yeah.
And then my mother passed away at I was also in Busaga in 84. And the inability to bury her was also something that has always stuck with me. And I think it is only because of the community that one has survived.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting. You talk about that vigilance, and one wonders if it's specifically a South African condition, the vigilance that you have, knowing that even in an assumed or a known sort of group mission, group struggle, there are those erstwhile comrades or friends or colleagues that you can look at and say, but I know who you are, or I know what you've done. But because of the greater mission, we carry on. Do you think that's necessarily a South African condition of carrying on despite, because you're looking at the end goal? Or is it, as you say, the work of an artist who's had to synthesize, you know, life and understanding life and the motivations of human beings?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder how you square all of that, and then, as you say, as a cultural activist, then call on whatever those inspirations are or those anxieties are to create or to engender creativity and art and writing that, you know, motivates people to either take up arms or to support a cause, or just quite frankly to carry on and to find meaning and create meaning in their own lives.
Well, I do believe that there is nothing as resilient as the human spirit. And so, and the need to survive, the need to carry on, you can be bogged down by your, what does Baldwin say? He says, when people discover that they are no longer capable of having access to their hatred, they are left with pain.
Mm.
I do not want to be left with pain. I want to be left with a consciousness of what's going on in the world. And I think that, as you are asking, it's a universal thing. Many, many, many people in the world have been betrayed. And the betrayals are also of another level when it comes to people being betrayed by their leaders, placing all sorts of hopes in specific people, only to find that that hope has been blasphemed.
Mm.
And I do not, I will continue to create, sleeping with one eye open, knowing that, you know, every day, as someone once said, is a struggle, but every day also is a gift.
Mm. Every day is a struggle and every day is a gift. When you look ahead, I know that, In a conversation, you've mentioned that, you know, looking ahead, you're currently working on more writing on another book, and you are interested in young adult fiction. And I guess the question is, why young adult fiction? What do you want to leave young South Africans with, young Africans with, by way of a literary legacy or creative legacy?
Well, I want them to be left with one thing, which is very important, and that is to not make the mistakes that we have made. To always, always, always ask questions, even when it's unlikely that they will get truthful answers. And I think the act of writing is an act of inquiry. It's an act of going to the dark and trying to tease out from it strands of reality that can make, that can sustain life, that can make people reach the best of themselves.
Mm. In our conversation, you've mentioned obviously your own family's history in the struggle, and I wonder when you when you think, you know, when you talk about your family, but also when you think about your own children that you also talk about quite a lot in many interviews. The sense of history that you want to leave them with, or at least the sense of their own agency in historical events and in the trajectory of that country or in the trajectory of the world, what is it that you want to leave them with, and perhaps maybe trace that back to growing up in your own home, in your own household? You're born in Stanger in KwaZulu-Natal, you grew up in KwaMashu. You know, what was that soil that you and your siblings were planted in, the water that you were nurtured with, so that, you know, when big scary historical events came along, you confronted them and you did what you could or what you felt was necessary?
We were lucky in the sense that we had parents that gave us access to books, to all sorts of material that made us understand what was going on in the country. I think that the one thing I would like to leave this world knowing is happening is that young people have got access to those archives of our lives and the lives of others that sustained us. Because in reading about Chief Albert Luthuli, for me, when I was young, reading about Dora Tamana, reading about some of the people that are still alive today, help make shape, teach me something about life, teach me about the experience of being a human being. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to make sure, you know, we've got a country where we've got such bad attitude towards reading. The older generations have got to fight tooth and nail to make sure that they leave the legacy of reading and writing for the coming generations. Mm-hmm. Because it is only through some of that that they will survive, I think.
Yeah. And speaking of reading and also, you know, going back into and assuming a responsibility or control over, you know, our shared memories, our shared archives, and continuing a legacy that was started, you know, a long time ago. Well, of course, we touched on the fact that you continued the work of former President Nelson Mandela by writing or closing off his works and his writings with Dare Not Linger, The Presidential Years, Volume 2 of his autobiography, but also, you know, putting your hand or lending your hand to collection of poetry by a fellow Sasa activist, Ukwala. And I just wonder what it means to go back in time in that sense. And, you know, I guess not be intimidated by the fact that you weren't there at that moment when this person was writing this work or this poetry, but saying, I can assume the mantle and I'm quite confident that I'll do this work justice, this memory justice.
Well, that was one of a labor of love, really, putting together Mafika Kwala's poetry, because it was Mafika, in a very strange way, who catapulted me onto this journey of writing. Mafika and another creative person, Omar Bacha, they are the ones that inspired me to perhaps stop doing paintings and drawings and write the stories in forms of short stories or poems. And so I think one of the things that perhaps we also need to stress on is that we as South Africans, we do not read each other. We do not read each other's works. We hardly know each other's contributions to the cultural arena. And that has got to come to a stop. We've got to support one another as much as possible. The young writer is what you might have been a long, long time ago in the past.
Yeah. We're going to leave it right there. Time is never enough, but thank you so much for your time this morning. And of course, thank you so much for your latest work, The Lost Language of the Soul. It truly is a South African novel, so timely and so important.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Rufile.
Mandla Langa is a novelist, a poet, and a cultural activist. His latest novel, The Lost Language of the Soul, published by Picador Africa.